Hello and welcome to the Energy Pioneers Podcast, a show dedicated to the legacy of the pioneers of the offshore oil and gas industry. I'm energy historian Jason Terrio. Each podcast episode features stories of industry pioneers whose leadership, grit, and technological expertise built the modern offshore industry in the Gulf of Mexico and around the world. For more than two decades, the Houston-based Oilfield Energy Center, now the Energy Education Foundation, has honored these legendary men and women by inducting them into the OEC's Hall of Fame. The stories you will hear are from the Hall of Famers themselves, whose original interviews, some recorded 25 years ago, have been digitally remastered and preserved for posterity. Oil well disasters, blowouts, fires, oil spills, burning smoke, injuries, and loss of life. These are the unfortunate aspects of the oil and gas industry that have been around since the beginning. Well control experts have played important roles in the oil field through time. These experts knew how to handle major incidences, put out fires and drill relief wells, create new tools for use, and manage pollution control. Much like the roughnecks and offshore divers, the well control professionals of the past had a certain swagger, ruggedness, and go-get-it attitude that personified this difficult and dangerous job that nobody wanted, but everyone came to depend on. One name stands out, the feisty, fearless, firefighting legend from Texas, Paul Red Adair. Red Adair's remarkable career spanned nearly 60 years. He started in the oil industry in the 1930s and served in a bomb disposal unit during World War II. His oil well firefighting career took off in the late 1940s under the tutelage of Myron Kinley. In 1959, Adair went off on his own and co-founded the Red Adair Company, which specialized in extinguishing oil well fires and capping blowouts. His innovative approach to well control, combined with a fearless attitude, quickly earned him a reputation as a hellfighter. The title to a 1969 Hollywood film, loosely based on his career, starring none other than John Wayne. Adair's methods were often unconventional, risky, but cutting edge. He incorporated firefighting techniques with the use of explosives and specialized tools to cut off the free-flowing oil and devastating blazes to cap burning wells, thus averting further disaster and environmental damage. His first run at capping a blowout was in Arkansas with Otis Pressure Control.
I went to work for Otis Pressure Control. And the first job I worked on was in Smackover, Arkansas, and the well got away from us, and the valve was still hanging, so I put a bolt in and put it back on. I almost got fired, and that's how I really got started. And from then on, it's come natural. Back in those days, see, 2,000, 3,000-foot well, they're pretty deep wells. And so it was fairly easy to cap, and that's how I got started. And in the meantime, they'd already called Kinley. And he got there, he wanted to see who this red-headed kid was. So he come over to me and he said, "Say, son, this is the type of work I do." And I said, "Well, it's fun, isn't it?" And that's how I met Mr. Kinley, and from the rest of it goes on.
Adair worked many years for Myron Kinley, a well-known oilfield firefighter and well control expert who taught Red the basics of the business. They fought the infamous Catco oil fire in the Gulf of Mexico in 1958, which made headlines across the country and paved the way for Red Adair's future career. After more than a decade of experience putting out fires and capping wells, Red Adair charted his own path with his own company. He soon gained notoriety as a leading expert in the offshore oil and gas industry.
See, that's when one of the biggest ones, because they had one earlier, and Mr. Kinley worked on it, and I was somewhere else, and that's when we went on Catco, I think in 1958, and worked on it, and that's when I designed shape charges to shoot those well heads off. I think there's about 27 wells on that platform, it's hard to remember, and everything was burnt up, so we had to get in there and look at each well head, and we'd go in a basket, and we'd hang boots and coots with me, and we'd hang on each well head to see what was left, and that's how we began to put it together, and each well was some were dual completion, some triple completion, and we made a shape charge called a flying saucer, and it shoot outside in, We could shoot those whale heads off and just lift them off. And then we had a stinger to go down inside of them. You imagine all kind of things when you're out there working, and you sit back. And I believe the hardest part was clearing away the debris and getting us a platform and there to work off of. And once we got in there, well, it was fairly easy. One way working offshore is sometimes easier than it is onshore, because you have all of the equipment there available for you, such as your derrick barges and your pumps and equipment to work with. And you can stay with the job. Where on land, a lot of time you have to haul water and rig up, and it takes a lot of time to get rigged up. But each one of them has its good parts and its bad parts. But to me, it wouldn't make me any difference whether it's onshore or offshore. I mean, worked on one that had a floating, had a tender come up to a stationary platform, and it would pull up and it would have a ramp. It would have to run up and get work on it. And we worked out of Louisiana, I think. First one had a tender and a jack-up platform, and that's the first one. And what was so rough about it was running up and down that platform, you know, carrying equipment back and forth. And that's how we really got started.
As the industry continued to expand offshore, Adair's expert team developed new techniques and new equipment. As the court of last resort, they eventually became the premier well control service company around the world. One of the most notorious disasters they fought during the heyday of the Gulf of Mexico was the Baymarchand blowout in 1970, just off the coast of Grand Isle, Louisiana.
Oh, Baymarchand, yeah. I remember that one because, see, we got out there and we had to rig up a directional drilling because we could have put the fire out, but that's when this pollution we had, I don't know how many wells were on fire exactly, but we had oil going everywhere. And if we'd have put it out, we'd have really had a lot of oil in close to Grand Isle. And so they decided to let it burn, so we drilled relief wells. And like relief wells, not always successful. So on the last well, they couldn't kill it. So we had to go and kill it. We already planned ahead what we were going to do. So it was Raymond, I think, and Richard and myself, and I don't know, was one of them with us, hard to remember. But we got in there and we had a little crane. We went and cut everything off and we put a braiding head on it, put the blowout vent on it, got it closed in. And one thing that was bad about the tide would come up and down. We had a little platform and we're about to remember the air hammer to take these bolts out. And Raymond got underneath this platform. And thank God he held that hose because he got underneath the expanded metal and he couldn't come up. He almost drowned. So we had to pull him back out. So these things you don't get into before, but when you get in there, you learn it. So that's how you learn by getting into it. But we finally got it. But that's when we come along, we just boom for cleaning up and we use all kind of dispersants on the beach. But they did a real good job. It was for Shell Oil Company. They did a real good job on the pollution control, everything on that job. And I don't believe anybody ever got hurt on it. No, we had the best safety record of anybody in the world. Well, we look after each other, and each guy, when we go in there, we're working, and one guy, if it's real dangerous in there, one guy's watching all the time, and the others are working, so if it doesn't, he grabs you, and you know that time to move. And you'd be amazed how many times you have to move in and out of there. And it's a funny sense you have when a well's going to do something, you have this funny feeling, and you move out, and sure enough, moved out, and drill pipe come out. Other time, we move back, and the thing catch fire. So it's somebody looks after you upstairs. And a lot of people said, Red, why don't you get into this kind of business, get into that? Well, I figured the best thing is stay what you know. And ours was well-controlled business, and that's what we did. And we were the best at it, because you stayed that, and you didn't disperse into something else, and because your men had plenty of work. If you did enough blowouts, you're busy enough.
When the Ixtox well offshore Mexico in the Bay of Campeche blew out in 1979, Red Adair got the call to respond. The gushers continued to spill oil into the ocean for 7 long months, making it one of the largest oil spills in history.
Oh, Ixtox, oh, that was a bucket of worms. See, what happened at Ixtox 1, what really happened at well, when they put all the well heads on above the ocean floor, they'd welded the pipe on it, just put a weld around the pipe, put the braid and everything on top. And that was a weak part of it, was where it welded on. I think a 10 3/4 inch casing. And we capped the weld all right and went through it, and we had 5 inch pipe rammed and down to 3 inch and then blanks. And we got the deck where we put flow lines into the weld head when we put it on there. And it worked. And then we closed the 5 inch rams and the pressure dropped, I think, about 1,600 pounds. We'd pump it in, looked good, looked great. Then we closed the 3-inch ram, then the pressure went down a little bit and started pumping more and more, and then all of a sudden, went over and the well head fell off. And that was when all the trouble started. and they tried pumping these 2-inch steel balls and lead balls in it, and then they come up with a sombrero deal to put over it. And I bet them, they wouldn't call them a bet, I bet them $1 million that it wouldn't work. And it looked like he took a shotgun and he shot holes in that thing, but it shook that thing and it was shaking. We had to get it back off. But on the relief well, when we finally got killed, Jesse Chevrier was there with me, and I was the only gringo there when we pumped into it. And what we did to kill it, we put a drilling rig over it, we run drill pipe, I think 3.5-inch drill pipe, all the way to bottom. And then through the relief well, we pumped in, we did what you call a gunk squeeze. We flushed that drill pipe out with diesel oil. We put diesel and cement, and it worked slicker than a whistle. And there was so much oil, I think really most of the oil that come out of Estoc 1 come tankers coming out of Tampico, Mexico, because we would fly over it in a plane going back and forth to Carmen. And heck, we'd see a sheen over there where the well was blowing out. But up north, there was a different crude. But there was a lot of excitement going on. And that's when we designed this wellhead, and we put a big buoy out by the side of this room, and we had a swivel on the inside that no matter what happened, the boats that pumped in Halliburton boats could swivel all the way around that thing and pump. Once you start pumping, you don't quit. And that's where all the pumping took place. And it was Mac Gibb helped us do all of this. And it was a job getting on that big buoy and hooking up all those lines. They went down through it, and then they come back up. And we used that Corflex and hold onto the deal. But on the relief well, we put drill pipe in it, and we had these valves in the drill pipe. So when we started pumping the well, it went on vacuum. We picked up the drill pipe, and they closed the valve and put a tree on it. We would pump down the drill pipe or the casing. And you could monitor the pressure and the temperature and all of this. But it went, a lot of went on to it. There's a lot of hard work in it.
How long did you work on the Estoc
1? Oh, about 7 months. And then when I was leaving going to another job, then Lasseter with Pemex, they would go in and start working, doing different. We killed that thing about 5 times. We got ready to leave the next morning. They pump in it, hear it come back. But it was a lot of excitement.
For all of his experience capping thousands of wild wells over the decades, nothing could have prepared Red Adair for the carnage that he saw with the Piper Alpha incident in the North Sea, which led to 167 deaths, making it the deadliest offshore disaster in history.
As far as men being killed, it was really terrible when you get in there. And Raymond and Brian and I, when we flew in it, we first looked at the platform, and it's leaning 45 degrees and all this oil and burning. And I looked at Raymond, I said, man, we got our hands full here. And sure enough, once we got to working in there, and we used that Theris, that firefighting vessel that we designed, and we designed two of them. And thank God we had it over there. We were able to get in there and work. And we got all 36 wells done in 31 days. Once you get in there working, but you plan ahead on each one of them. And we were able to get through with it. But what was bad each time you'd go in and work, to be in there at night trying to find bodies and them bags, plastic bags, and it kind of gets to you quite a bit. And it was a shame, but we finally got everyone of them killed. But it was like each job had its own problem. And a lot of people were worrying about the Piper platform going to fall over, and they couldn't pull it over. But it went real good, and it was Occidental, and it got into politics a little bit, but we got through with it and went on home.
In the early 1990s, following the historic capping of hundreds of burning wells in the Kuwaiti oil fields, Red Adair finally retired. But he passed on his wisdom and experience to numerous others who worked for him and with him through the years. Mike Shellman, a well-controlled professional, knew Red Adair and followed his remarkable career. Mike agreed to join the podcast and to share his perspective on Red Adair's influence on the industry. Welcome, Mike.
My name is Mike Shellman. I'm 72 years old and have worked in the Texas oil field since I was 10 years old. I first met Red Adair when I was 12 on a blowout my father had on one of his drilling rigs. Mr. Adair came to the location in a big red Cadillac. I said yes sir and no sir, got to shake his hand, and when he left he gave me a Red Adair company sticker that I still have to this day. 7 years later, I was working as a roughneck on a drilling rig in South Texas when the well blew out. Adair came to fix it. When he asked for volunteers to help, I jumped right in. I worked with Mr. Adair on another blowout 2 years later. When I was in my mid-40s, I had the great fortune to work for two of Adair's old employees, Boots Hansen and Coots Matthews. I went on blowouts all over the world for Boots and Coots for 3 years. Myron Kinley, Red Adair, Boots and Coots were my childhood heroes when I was growing up. That I had the opportunity to actually work for them elbow to elbow was a great honor and something I will never forget. As the years have gone by, I became a great student of the history of Allwell firefighting, beginning as far back as 1913, and have written papers about it, helped produce documentaries about the well control history for the Discovery and History channels, donated photographs to the George Bush Presidential Library and the University of Texas, and spoken to literally thousands of people all over the country about the history of well control. The last time I saw Red Adair was about the time he was retiring in 1998. He and Coots Matthews, my old friend David Thompson, also an all-well firefighter, and I had lunch together in a big steakhouse off the Katy Freeway in Houston. It was on a Friday afternoon and the place was packed. We all had a few drinks and Red and Coots started telling stories about the old days. Because they were both deaf from 4 decades of working on blowing wells, they literally had to shout at each other over the lunch table. The entire restaurant, hundreds of people, got completely silent and listened. When lunch was over and the four of us were walking out, everybody in the whole restaurant stood up and applauded Coots Matthews and Red Adair. It was amazing. Red always had the time to talk to you, to ask how you were, how your personal life was. Despite being a legend in the oil field, he was just another oil field hand at heart, like the rest of us. He always treated the common man with great respect, always.
In 1998, when the Offshore Energy Center inducted Red Adair into its Hall of Fame and had him interviewed by oil historian Jule Pratt, the industry was undergoing dramatic changes. Red Adair's final message touched on the true nature of what makes the oil field work. The innovations of numerous individuals and their independent companies that develop the technology bit by bit, which allows the industry and oil companies to continue the march of progress.
See, I'm 83 now, so Kinley and they've passed on, and Patton was over 100. But I look at some of these guys that come up with these little independent tools that you make that develop the oil patch, and it wasn't for the small guys out there, I don't believe it'd go very far, because it takes the wildcatters. And he's got little tools, little companies that can, you know, like satellite companies that make the oil industry what it is. And the big companies like Shell, Exxon, all the big ones on these small wells, they wouldn't fool with these little ones, will it? So it's a cycle that goes round and round. And see, like the first tools I come up with, I helped design the first tubing calipers out. And there's the back-off charges, like do all of this stuff. And help work on the first wireline valve. And I got $25 for it. So the oil industry is good to me, so anything that we develop, we turn it back into the oil industry. And instead of patenting and fighting these lawsuits, it takes people like that that makes it. And like those shape chargers they used to make, we didn't patent none of that stuff, like pipe cutter and all this stuff. And we went back to the oil industry. And this way I look at all the stuff and they say, boy, you could have done this, you could have done that. But I just didn't look at it like that because the oil industry is really good to me. And my motto is do it right the first time. Because it's awful hard to do it right the second time. Because when you load up on a big shape charger to go in and shoot the fire out with 700 pounds of glycerin or whatever, it takes a while time to get it all built up and you cool it down. And if you miss the shot, then you got to go all through that again. And it's there you go 2 or 3 days and doing it. So that's when you do it right the first time. The oil industry is, to me, I think the greatest group of people in the world and to work with. And well, just don't ever give up. The oil field is going to be here for a long time. It'll take a long time to make it. Just get in there and don't give up.
This concludes our episode of the Energy Pioneers Podcast. I'm the host, Jason Terrio. Stay tuned for more episodes and be sure to check out the new Energy Education Foundation website at energyeducation.org, where you can learn more about the Offshore Hall of Famers. And if you ever come to Galveston, Texas, be sure to visit the Ocean Star Offshore Drilling Rig Museum, which pays tribute to the men and women and companies that built the offshore oil and gas industry.